Our third case this morning is ISI International against either 1, 2, or 3 law partnerships.
Good morning. May it please the court, David Crossman on behalf of the appellant. This is the appeal from the third dismissal of ISI's complaint for the district court on forum non-convenience grounds. Usually the dismissal on forum non-convenience grounds is a disposition of last resort after the court has determined whether it has subject matter, jurisdiction, or personal jurisdiction. In this case, however, the district court decided that those issues would be moot even though they were contested by the appellees and moved directly to the forum non-convenience issue. The district court's dismissal on forum non-convenience grounds is not supported by any of the Gilbert factors, beginning with the question of the adequacy of the forum in Ottawa or Ontario. In the brief by Borden, Ladner, Gervais that's before the court this morning, augmented by a very substantial compendium of Canadian law, Borden, Ladner, Gervais has confirmed that the Ottawa courts would not be an adequate forum for the trial of ISI's claims because, as stated in their brief, Ottawa law bars ISI from asserting a claim against Borden, Ladner, Gervais in the Canadian courts. As to the other two aspects of the Gilbert analysis, the public interest factor analysis, the district court based its analysis primarily upon its belief that the law of Canada predominates in this case. The law of Canada does not predominate in this case. In reaching that conclusion, the district court acknowledged that a Lanham Act claim might seem at home in a U.S. district court, but then stated that, quote, the need to apply unfamiliar foreign law outweighs the court's interest in one claim. By making that statement, the district court, I believe, acknowledged that it did not recognize that ISI's other claims for false, tortious interference with the prospective business advantage.
After First Health against BCE emerges, is there any Lanham Act claim here?
I believe there is, Your Honor.
Indeed. Is there any federal claim at all here?
I believe that the concerted approach of a series of letters to every individual or business that ISI was dealing with at
there
that time.
There was a series of letters in BCE emerges.
That's correct. But I believe that in this case, they constitute such a level of promotion of Dr. Reitzma's
There were
business.
Hundreds of letters in BCE emerges, more than I can see likely here.
If indeed the Lanham Act claim were to be dismissed, there would still be the basis under diversity jurisdiction for all of the remaining claims in this case.
Well, there would be. Maybe it's just too late to go back and rethink the personal jurisdiction question. But of course, this case landed in federal court. Or at least landed in Illinois, given our analysis the last time around, precisely because there was a federal statute, and therefore it could be brought in Illinois, notwithstanding the potential fact that maybe these defendants were not amenable to service in Illinois, if this were wholly a state law claim. Now, the question I'm asking is, given that we now know, seems to me, from BCE emerges, that there is no real Lanham Act claim here, doesn't that make sending this case to Canada look a lot more reasonable?
I would say it makes it look more reasonable, but not reasonable enough to satisfy the forum non-convenience grounds. given the fact that the law...
Do we need to do anything other than make it look reasonable, given deferential appellate review? The basic decision is one made by the district court. We're supposed to reverse the district court if it's gone wacky. What I'm getting at is that it looks a lot less wacky if one thinks that maybe there wasn't really a federal claim here.
There may not be a federal claim if the Lanham Act claim were removed, but there still are the claims arising under the United States law, and United States law still predominates in this case. With respect to the issue that has been newly raised for the first time on appeal by the appellee, there is possibility that in the alternative the district court would not have subject matter jurisdiction because there is no basis for diversity. I recall the court's attention to the fact that with respect to Ms. Brown, who is the partner in Canada, who is also a United States citizen, that she has consistently maintained her right in the United States to vote in the federal elections, including the last election of the year 2000. She is certainly entitled to do this, even though she is residing outside of the United States, but she does so through the state where she last resided, claiming her rights as a citizen of that state to vote in that state's elections for its senators, for its congressmen.
That sounds like fraud on her part.
It doesn't
sound like a reason why there would be diversity of citizenship. If you're not domiciled in a state, you're not entitled to vote there. And domicile means intent to remain or intent to return if you are elsewhere temporarily. From the description in these papers, this person is not out of the state temporarily with an intent to return.
It would seem that she has been out for a long time, but the Uniform and Overseas Voters Act refers to the right of a citizen who is going to reside abroad to continue to exercise the rights of citizenship in the states where they were last residing before they left to go abroad. She is exercising those rights. So to the extent that she is exercising those rights, she is maintaining her citizenship, exercising her citizenship rights in that particular state. Whether it is Vermont or New York is unclear. Certainly it is not the state of Illinois. With respect to the other issues that need to be considered in the Gilbert analysis, the district court stated that Ontario has a strong interest in regulating and disciplining its attorneys, which may be true. But this is neither a regulatory nor a disciplinary action. This is an action for torts committed against an Illinois corporation, which we believe would be regarded as torts within the state of Illinois. And as to those claims, the district court for the Northern District of Illinois has a stronger interest than the court in Ottawa. As to the private interest factors which the court considered, the court concluded that it would be in the private interest for the case to go to Canada because Borden, Ladner, Gervais, or I take that back, Scott and Aylin's insurance would be greater in Canada because it does not cover claims in the United States. But if the insurance contract is in evidence and it states that it does not cover, it only covers claims which are first filed in Canada, so consequently, the insurance would not apply in Canada because this case was first filed outside. It is accurate that there are two witnesses who do reside in Canada whose testimony, if this case proceeds in the United States in the district court, would probably be by deposition, possibly augmented by television. It has not been established, however, that either of these witnesses have specific information that they would be able to testify to, or its relevance to the particular claims in this case against the particular defendants. For example, there is no indication that Dr. Reitzman will testify to anything, as opposed to claiming that his conversations and communications with the defendants, Scott and Nayland, were all privileged under the attorney-client privilege and not testify to anything at all. So as to these adding up of the Gilbert factors. The Gilbert factors, I believe, argue for retaining rather than giving up this case to go to Canada because predominant law is in the United States that controls. Dr. Reitzma was an employee of the ISI Corporation, and as such, she was employed to develop the CombiVac invention. And under the laws of Illinois, the employer, not Dr. Reitzma, is the owner of the patent. Subsequent to this court's last decision, the Patent and Trademark Office did issue the patent in the United States that was revived after its long abandonment, which is now issued to ISI International, but the international patents under the Patent Cooperation Treaty have not so issued. So the private interest factors in this case do not tip decisively in favor of the alternative forum, nor do the public interest factors. And it is our position that since Borden-Ladner has taken the position that ISI cannot proceed against it if this matter is transferred to Canada, whereas the district court concluded that Borden-Ladner would be a defendant in the case, the absolute impossibility of proceeding against Borden-Ladner in Canada precludes that forum as being an adequate forum for the claims of ISI in this case. And if there is no immediate question, I'd like to reserve some time for my rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel.
Mr. DeJong.
Good morning. May it please the court. Peter Mohn from Baker & McKenzie is also at counsel table. He's additional counsel for the patent agents. Let me start by taking up the question as to the number of letters at issue in this case. There are only two letters at issue in the case, the letter sent to MediMaid in Oss in the Netherlands and the letter sent to ATP, American Pharmaceutical Partners, in Santa Monica. It's only the letter to APP that's at issue in the Lanham Act claim. So the number of private, non-anonymous communications that are at issue here, the language relied on in First Health, there is only one. It is not commercial advertising or promotion based on that. This court's holding in that case under the Lanham Act. Let me also clarify, if you look at the affidavit submitted by Carol Brown, it does not say she votes in state elections. She votes only in federal elections, which as a U.S. resident abroad, she is permitted to do. The district court wasn't wacky here. The district court touched each of the bases, considered each of the factors it was required to, that this court directed it to in its remand opinion. And in looking at each of those factors and exercising its discretion, district court reached the right decision. First, there is no issue that Ontario is an adequate forum. There was a question about the admissibility of deposition evidence. That now has been abandoned. ISI now has this new argument, which is that somehow its claim is not, Ontario is not an adequate forum for its claim because its claim against BLG would be foreclosed. Mr. Abrams will address that further on behalf of BLG, but I think there are really two points to keep in mind. Whether that issue is litigated in Illinois or that issue is litigated in Ontario, the same law will govern it. The governing law on that issue is Ontario law. It's the liability as between those two partnerships that is a matter of contract and a law of Ontario. In fact, the governing law, and there are three issues that are governed here by Ontario law. We've got the issue, to start with, the liability of BLG for these alleged claims. We've got the issue of the duties owed by Scott Malin's lawyers and patent agents. Those issues are also governed by Ontario law. And then finally, we've got the issue of the license and what role it plays in this. And I would invite the court to go through the license, and I want to highlight some of the key provisions of the license because the document is critical to these claims. The license covers the patent applications, divisions of that, as well as all license know-how. It's an all-encompassing license. The licensor, ISI's, only rights in the device, the invention of Dr. Reitzma, derived from from the license. If you go to paragraph 3.2 of the license, ISI explicitly agrees that it will not use or exploit the license patent or license know-how except in the manner that is authorized by this agreement. The license at paragraph 8.1 provides licensor, Dr. Rietsma, may terminate this agreement if the licensee becomes insolvent or enters into or is petitioned into bankruptcy, receivership, or ceases to conduct business for a period of 2 consecutive calendar months. And such termination shall become effective immediately upon the mailing of the notice of termination to the licensee. That's what happened here. Dr. Rietsma relied upon two of these provisions, the not doing business for 2 consecutive months and the insolvency. Whether or not those facts are satisfied is going to be adjudicated under Ontario law. And as we've talked about in the private interest factors, the witnesses to those issues are in Ontario also. Paragraph 9.1 of the license provides, in the event of termination of this agreement by expiry or pursuant to the provisions paragraph 8 hereof, the licensee, ISI, shall immediately discontinue all use of the license, patent, or license know-how. That means if the license was terminated, as the district court found, ISI didn't have any right to commercialize the device. ISI didn't have any right to enter into a contract with APP. It didn't have any right at that point.
What you're now arguing is essentially a defense on the merits. How does that help us determine
it is not
in what forum this case should be litigated?
An element of a tort claim is injury. If you don't have any right to enter into a contract, you have not been injured.
Then why do you want this case transferred to Ontario? The first time this case was here, this was my major question. Why do the parties care? If you're so confident of your defense on the merits, why have you been spending now closing in on 3 years demanding that some other tribunal adjudicate the merits?
Because
seems to me you would have said to the district court, we're entitled to win, give us judgment on the merits. And this case would have been over, on your view, more than 2 years ago.
Because my client's ability to prevail on the merits turns on what witnesses it can compel to testify at trial. Its ability to compel those witnesses to testify at trial, obviously, is better in Ontario. That's where Dr. Rietsma is. That's where Max Wood is. Two critical witnesses. I can't get them to testify in Illinois. That's one. I think that as the district court acknowledged, the district court is less able than an Ontario court to apply these three key legal issues that are governed by Ontario law. I see that my time is out.
Mm-hmm.
No other questions?
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Abrams.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Lee Abrams, representing Borden Ladner Gervais. First of all, we endorse and support Mr. DeJong's arguments why this case should be dismissed and Judge Conlon's order should be affirmed. But even if the court were to remand this case, we respectfully urge that Borden Ladner Gervais be let out now, because the uncontroverted facts and the uncontroverted law, never challenged in anything in ISI's papers, established that ISI cannot recover against Borden Ladner Gervais. And unquestionably, Ontario law governs the relationship between Borden Ladner Gervais and Borden Elliott Scott and Allen. These are two Ontario partnerships, both of which continue to exist. As we've indicated in the papers, Borden Elliott Scott and Allen files tax returns and continues to be an existing entity under Ontario law. The contracts between Borden Elliott Scott and Allen and Borden Ladner Gervais first of all, as I said, are between two Ontario partnerships. Secondly, they expressly provide that Ontario law will govern. And that law will govern no matter where the case is tried. Under Ontario law, it is clear that there was no merger. There was an acquisition of assets pursuant to an express agreement by the managing partners of the legacy firms. First of all, an oral agreement, later confirmed by a written agreement, which was a condition precedent to the creation of Borden Ladner Gervais, and that was a commitment, because this was a matter of some concern to each of the legacy firms, a commitment that Borden Ladner Gervais was not assuming any liabilities of any of the five legacy firms for conduct that occurred prior to the creation of Borden Ladner Gervais. And that includes the liability that is alleged to exist here. The managing partners had a telephone conference in which they agreed orally, and under Ontario law, that establishes a condition precedent to the creation of Borden Ladner Gervais. As long as there is not an integration clause in the formation agreements, the oral agreement is binding. In this case, there is no integration clause in the ultimate agreement. So there is this oral agreement among the managing partners, which they then confirmed in writing. And again, under Ontario law, this writing could be executed later. It doesn't have to be contemporaneous with or prior to the creation documents. These documents all establish, and the evidence is uncontroverted, Borden Ladner Gervais would not exist but for the collective agreement regarding non-assumption of pre-existing liabilities for prior conduct. So there is no assumption of any liability. Borden Ladner Gervais is not a successor in law to those liabilities, and indeed would, as I said, would not have come into existence. Furthermore, the law of Ontario, unchallenged in any of ISI's papers, either in the district court or in this court, establishes the doctrine of privity of contract that applies in Anglo-Canadian law that's exactly opposite and counterintuitive to what we think of as the right of a third-party beneficiary to sue on a contract. The law is clear in Ontario, and that law is binding, that if A owes a debt and B enters into a contract with A that says, I will pay that debt to X, nevertheless, X cannot sue B under Ontario law. That's just the way it is. As strange as it is, it struck me as very strange when I heard it, but the law, as we've set it forth in the briefs, is unchallenged by ISI, and I submit that the absence of challenge, the silence...
And it's too late to go to the Privy Council and ask it to review Canadian law.
I think so, but I think...
They've repatriated their law from that particular device.
All of the Ontario law on this point, as we have articulated it, stands unchallenged, and I suggest that the silence of ISI on these issues is as compelling as the silence of the dog that didn't bark in the Sherlock Holmes adventure of Silver Blaze. There is silence here because there is nothing to be said to the contrary. Borden Ladner Gervais does not belong in this case, and therefore we respectfully urge that the court let it out, regardless of what it does with respect to Judge Conlon's order. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Crossman?
Briefly, Your Honor. I'd first like to note that the portions of the license that Mr. DeYoung was reading, where the references are to ISI, that is not to the plaintiff in this case. That is to Mr. Reitzma's corporation up there.
That was to ISI Ontario.
ISI Ontario or ISI Canada. Which was his license from himself, basically to himself, after he had agreed with Jukari in Texas that the invention, with their help, would be the property of, exclusively, the corporation that was then acquired by ISI. Also, with respect to the license, it should, as we've noted previously, that this was entered into before Dr. Reitzma became an employee and was engaged to invent and develop the product, and entered into a non-compete agreement with ISI, which is governed by the law of the state of Illinois. finally, in looking at the complications that have been engrafted onto this case, they certainly were not part of this case when ISI's complaint was filed. The issues with respect to Borden, Ladner, Gervais, and Scott and Nayland, and Borden, Elliott, Scott and Nayland, all came in more than a year after the filing of the complaint and the first motion to dismiss on forum non-convenience grounds by reason of the activities of the defendants thereafter. Accordingly, we would ask that the district court's order on the dismissal on forum non-convenience grounds be vacated.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, counsel. Thanks to all counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.